If you Google the words anger management, most of the images you get are white men yelling or pointing or breaking things or yelling at each other. And that's how we think about anger and anger management. But in fact, the rest of us are managing our anger 24/7.
This is It's Okay That You're Not Okay, and I'm your host, Megan Devine. This week on the show, we are talking about anger, that much maligned, much needed, normal, healthy emotion. My guest this week is Soraya Shamali, author of the incredible book, Rage Becomes Her. Settle in, friends. This hot topic coming up right after this first break.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Before we get started, two quick notes. One, this episode is an encore performance. I am on break working on a giant new project, so we're releasing a mix of our favorite episodes from the first three seasons of the show. Some of these conversations you might have missed in their original seasons, and some shows just truly deserve multiple listens so that you capture all of the goodness. Second note, while we cover a lot of emotional relational territory in our time here together, this show is not a substitute for skilled support with a licensed mental health provider or for professional supervision related to your work. Take what you learn here, take your thoughts and your reflections out into your world, and talk about it. Hey friends, I am so excited for this episode. Getting to talk to Soraya Shamali is a bucket list item for me. To be honest, one of the main reasons this show exists at all is so that I have a legit reason to talk to interesting people about difficult things. Now, you're going to hear about it in the episode itself, but I spent a lot of my 20s exploring the connections between grief, anger, women's rights, colorism, and environmental destruction, just like your average light topics. But getting to talk with somebody who also finds those topics fascinating and deeply interrelated was just a joy. Now, that is another thing you don't hear very often connected to anger, joy. Soraya and I cover a lot of territory in our time together, but I wanted to preface the entire conversation by saying that when you unleash your anger, you also access joy, connection, creativity, and all the things we've been taught will never happen if you allow yourself to be angry for more than a hot second. Soraya and I had such a great time together and talked for so long. This episode is now a two-parter. The joy stuff comes in part two. So be sure to come back for that next week because it's important and it's an awesome conversation. Part one here, we definitely dunk on the stages of grief. I mean, how could we not when we are talking about both anger and grief? But more than that, we get into the real reasons why anger is considered an unevolved, negative, dark emotion, something you're supposed to move through very quickly and something you should definitely not express. If you've ever found yourself swallowing your rage because it wouldn't be polite, and honestly, who hasn't done that, you are going to get so much out of this conversation. Now, we start fast and we cover a lot. Part one, right now, next week's part two. Both of them go into the listen several times folder for sure. Soraya, welcome to the show. I am so thrilled to talk with you today. Now, anger is actually one of my absolute favorite topics in the world. It's really tied to grief, of course, and we'll get into that later. But I kind of want to start out by saying the most common complaint that I get from my own work is that I'm too angry. And I really appreciate that feedback from people, because to me, that says, like, if you think I'm too angry, then I'm doing my job.
I'm just wondering what's the right amount of anger for them.
Right? What is the right amount of anger? Which is like this. I feel like we're going to probably spend our entire time together talking about the bullshit around the right amount of anger. But what is it about anger that freaks people out?
I think it depends on who's getting angry.
Mm.
Right? So I think it particularly freaks people out if the dispossessed, oppressed, powerless get angry. That's one kind of freak out, right? Because anger is an entitlement. You're entitled to be angry. Some people don't have that entitlement. I think it causes discomfort, and we don't like discomfort. You know, it causes sadness, it causes shame, it causes guilt, it elicits all of these negative and fearful emotions.
Yeah.
And in fact, it elicits anger when the angry person is violating norms, so gender norms in particular. Angry women are an oxymoron. We understand angry men, we really don't want to understand angry women.
No. And honestly, I think we excuse and allow angry men, but I don't think we understand angry men, because we don't. It's like there's one channel for anger, and it's like this violent, explosive, pissed off, destructive thing, which I think that really disses anger.
Yeah. And also, it's the one emotional channel that men have the right to without challenge, right? I mean, the fact is, we attribute emotionality to women, and then we use women's emotionality to punish and discipline and regulate them. But in fact, the result for men is that if they feel emotions that are softer, that are more feminine, they're conflicted, they feel shame, they're punished. You know, little boys who are sad or anxious or fearful are bullied by homophobes. I mean, it starts so early. And so the one form of emotional expression that is conflated with masculinity is anger. And that's super dangerous and damaging. It's damaging to the individual. It's dangerous for society. But, you know, even in adulthood, we really see the ways in which it gets distributed. So for a white guy to get angry is understandable to people, because it's how we define certain type of leadership. It's how we think of certain type of God, right? The angry, vengeful father. And so that confirms our stereotypes. So it doesn't make people so uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's bizarre that something so violent, punitive, oppressive doesn't bug people, right? As long as it comes from the right source.
The right source. I mean, if a black man, a black leader, a black president articulates anger, people are not comfortable. I mean, when Obama was president, we had an entire comedy routine sketch that the anger translator, the Key and Peele had an entire oeuvre that was just based on that, you know. And for men who don't have that kind of power, you know, a black man who sounds angry or looks angry, he doesn't even have to sound or look angry. He just needs to be a black man. Much more likely to be criminalized for that, you know, than followed as a leader in the broader community.
Yeah. And I think this comes back to something we hinted at a little bit when we first got started, which is like the uses of anger, what anger expresses, what it points to. Can we talk about that maybe a little bit for folks who are like, okay, the only anger I know is like the anger that burns the world down that white men have access to. So when we talk about anger, what are we talking about?
I mean, I think, first of all, we kind of live in a culture that thinks there are good emotions and bad emotions, right? We live in a very sort of binary and oppositional understanding of the world, and emotions fit into that framework. So the first thing I would say is there are no good or bad emotions, and anger in particular is a signal emotion. It's the emotion that warns us of threat or trouble or problems. And so from that perspective, we evolved to have anger so that we could survive, right? And so the question that I sort of ask in the book is, why do we sever this key emotion from femininity? Because when we do that, we take away the ability for a girl turning into a woman to identify the problem, name the problem, label the problem, figure out the relationships that matter to the problem, and then seek to change it. We're far, far more comfortable pathologizing an angry girl or woman, or silencing her, or medicating her, than listening to what she has to say, right? But in fact, if she can't do any of those things, she can't really help herself, you know? And so I think by the time you get to what you describe, the explosive, destructive, violent anger, the anger's already dysfunctional. It's already been suppressed or repressed or sort of tessellated into a really corrosive force in a person's life.
Yeah, that backlog of anger only has escape and explosion as its root. Like, you know, the image of sort of volcanic rage, right? Like there's this constant pressure, push this down, don't name it, don't say it, don't say that you don't like something, don't say that something isn't working for you. I often say, or talk about how, you know, for me, anger is a sense of injustice. It's a message that something is not right for you.
Right.
And we don't get to say those things, right? And if you don't get to say those things, they don't go away. They just get squished down and squished down and squished down. And they are going to find a way to speak those feelings of transgression and injustice.
And I think it's interesting, too, because you use the term anger management. And I wrote a lot about this, because if you Google the words anger management, most of the images you get are white men yelling or pointing or breaking things or yelling at each other. And that's how we think about anger and anger management. But in fact, the rest of us are managing our anger 24/7. And we're often mismanaging our anger. And that mismanagement of the anger is, I think, what you're talking about, when it turns into poor emotional regulation, bad physical health, long-term illness. I mean, there are no direct correlations between the suppression of anger and a variety of illnesses, but there are clear relationships between them, clear correlations between them that we don't understand very well. And so, in fact, for most of us, we need less anger management. We need better anger competence, better anger understanding.
I love that. I love that juxtaposition, or that definition of management as repression in a way, like how can you keep this quiet? I love that. I hadn't thought about it that way, that management is really suppression and quieting. And, you know, I'm all about grief literacy, but anger literacy is so closely tied with that. So, I mean, we're going here now. I had some other questions, but I think this is a good time to go to this. Like what's your relationship with grief, and does it overlap with your relationship with anger?
My relationship with anger evolved over my life. I was really socialized to ignore anger, to feel shame about anger. I lost the ability to recognize anger. I had so distanced myself from that. And it wasn't until I got to the point where I thought, why am I exhausted all the time? Why am I tired all the time? Why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? I didn't have words for that. And I really came to understand a couple of things, which is related to grief, which I'll explain in a minute. But once I was like, I forgot anger in my life. When I started to really realize it, it felt like I'd felt myself. I'd found myself again. I was like, I remember this. I remember being 7, 8, 9 before I went into good girl mode. I remember what it felt like to be angry and to say something about it as opposed to not say anything about it, right? And what happens to a lot of women, because we self-objectify very early in our culture, is we lose the ability to feel what anger feels like in our bodies and to recognize it. And that's really a first step for many women. It's literally saying, what is that? And then when we recognize it, the second step is to use the right language, because we are also really often taught in many families and cultures to minimize the anger that women have. So we say we're tired or we're stressed or we're irritated, or, you know, you find all of these ways that women minimize the thing that is bothering them, because in fact, they have learned that nobody really wants to hear what's bothering them, and that to say what's bothering them with force or with determination risks doing the one thing that women and girls are supposed to do, which is maintain these relationships. And you like break a relationship, which is the real threat.
Yeah. There's a passage in your, I think it was in an article I read of yours, where you were talking about how anger was disparaged in your childhood, and that the effect of that was managing your anger in a way that suppressed it and cut you off from it, resulted in social isolation, which is what you just described there, is like, which is so bizarre, because we suppress our anger. We pretend we're not angry. We say that we're tired instead of that we're mad,
right?
Because we're trying to hold on to those social bonds. And what you've explored is like, actually suppressing your anger is what breaks social bonds.
Right. And my point is that you can't really have a reciprocal caring relationship with a person if they don't know you and what you need. And anger is an expression of need or want, right? You need people to care about what is hurting you. And if you can't say that, then in essence, you're creating a false relationship. If your spouse or your father or whoever it is in your life that you are uncomfortable expressing your anger with, so girls will express anger towards other girls. You know, there's a lot of relational aggression that girls have, but they don't express it in the same way with boys around them, for example. They don't express it the same way to their parents. And so you see a lot of what I think of as horizontal anger among girls and women. They grow up to be women who are very disparaging of other women, very punitive with other women, but it's not vertical. It doesn't go along the axes that power flows on. And that's really important. But what I really learned that is to me the nexus of grief and anger, and this goes along with this idea that we live in such a binary world, is that we locate our emotions in a disembodied mind. We think of them as somehow outside of the body or closer to the body than the mind, but not of the body. But anger and grief are fully embodied. All of our emotions are fully embodied. And I had to unlearn my education. I had to unlearn the education of sort of Western enlightenment selfhood, which is very much that you're a mind and your body, and that rationality is different from emotionality and superior to emotionality. And, you know, we have all of these hierarchies built into our ways of knowing, and those are really damaging to our well-being, our relationships, our health, our ability to cope, to be resilient. All of these things, you know, are related.
Yeah, that Cartesian split between the head and the heart, and the head is prioritized above all else.
Right.
Right. Like that is just such trash. And in charge, right? And so this idea that intellectualism and stoicism and distance from the carnal body is what we choose. And you know, I spent a lot of my undergrad following the links in the chain between that separation and why we demonize women and why we demonize darker, you know, the darker you are. are, the closer you are to the earth. And that's terrifying for us. And like, there's, it's really the link that ties everything together, that demonization really of the body and all of the carnal emotion that comes with being embodied creatures, right? Like grief and love and sadness and anger and all of those things are just, they're not cool because we don't see them as clean.
We don't see them as pure or clean or in control. Like our philosophy, our science, our selfhood is very much built around this idea of an agentic person in control. But anger and grief are not about control.
Yeah.
You know, they actually highlight the ways in which we are not in control. And I would say too, that everything that you just described, everything we're talking about, the denigration of Black bodies, the denigration of brown bodies, the denigration of women's bodies, it's a form of terror management, because the fear of mortality, the fear of decay, the fear of illness, like all of the things that are part of being alive and being a being have been put into these containers of people. And so what you end up with is a worldview in which full of mind, able-bodied, white man becomes the idealized human being, and then the universalized human being. And in fact, in terms of anger, is the holder of anger that we are supposed to emulate or that we're supposed to put our trust in.
Mm. It's all about avoidance of pain, isn't it? I mean, all of the structures that we've created, all of the structures of oppression and who's okay and who's not okay. If that whole impetus is around, I don't like the things that remind me that I and the people I love and the things I care about are all temporary and subject to pain and injury and loss and suffering. If I don't want to feel those things, I need to make sure anything that reminds me of that is demonized, shunned, suppressed, because I don't want to know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to know that I am safe from pain. And seriously, like this, that whole avoidance of the reality of relatedness and pain is what has built the entire dominant repressive culture. It's like, it's batshit.
Yeah. And we haven't even talked about the sort of teleology of Christianity.
Mm.
Christianity created a linear time frame in which we are ultimately without end. Right? There's a limitlessness, and it's a movement towards perfection and growth. And it's all based on a renunciation of the flesh and a mortification of the flesh. And in fact, all it really does is disconnect us from living.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't think we can really talk about any of these things, whether it's white supremacy, male supremacy, fear, grief, anger, without thinking about just the material reality of life that our belief systems renounce.
Yeah, that separation and that rising above, and the amount of shame in religious systems if you are grieving, right? Like, oh, don't be sad because you'll see them again later. Like this whole overcoming of death. And I don't mean to shame anybody's religion or traditions that gives them comfort, but we do need to name that so much of the mechanics of religion is about nothing should hurt you because there's something better. It's still part of that avoidance of the embodied reality of pain and grief and relatedness. Like you can't be fully related and fully connected and fully in relationship with self, other, or the world if you don't allow yourself to feel what it feels to lose that connection.
Right. And also, I think, you know, if we go back to this notion, that sort of inexorable assumption that we will get to a better place, so you need to just trust that. Like, I think a lot about the stages of grief. Like, you should be moving through those stages. Aren't you at stage three yet? Like, you know, aren't you done with that yet? And in fact, that's just not the way grief works. It's not the way emotions work. It's not the way human beings work. And yet we hold people to that standard.
Absolutely.
And that's really damaging to them.
Yeah. I mean, the stages of grief are trash. And I've certainly talked about that a lot before. What I find super fascinating about people who are looking at the world through the stages of grief lens, like there are definitely favorite children in the stages, right? Like anger is part of the stages of grief, but don't stay there for too long. You have to get to acceptance. Like we made this whole system to make the messiness of human emotion approachable and measurable. Mm-hmm. And even within that system, anger is unwelcome. Right. We get that you might be a little bit angry, but it's not very evolved to feel it.
Right. And you know, it's interesting because I know this is definitely spiral thinking what we're going through. But again, there's this idea of a trajectory like trauma and post-traumatic growth. Right. And in fact, most grief is ambiguous grief. And so we have to go back to this notion of why control is so important. Because things like the stages or the propulsion or the linearity and the progress, those are just about the illusion of control. And I just think it would be better if we could culturally, philosophically, religiously, which I know many people try and do, give up that pressure to be in control, give up the really an illusion of control, because it is an illusion, right? And so having the cognitive flexibility to say, actually, I am grieving. I don't know when it will end. I cannot force myself not to feel this. And just being in the space, being and recognizing it, which is hard.
It's hard. It's hard for so many reasons. It's hard because we're not taught that that is normal and healthy and wise. And we also don't have the tools, cultural and interpersonal, we don't have the tools to navigate that.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant, players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We've been talking with best-selling author Soraya Shamali. Let's get back to it. And you said something really interesting a minute ago, and I'd love to hear more about it. You said that most grief is ambiguous grief. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
I think a lot of grief is ambiguous. I think that it's open-ended. I certainly know this in my life. There was a period in which I thought, well, grief is what you experience when someone dies. Someone dies and you experience grief. All of us will experience that grief. Everybody will experience that kind of grief. But in fact, we grieve for so many other things. And we grieve in circumstances where a death hasn't happened. And maybe it's the grief of mass incarceration killing a community. Maybe it's the grief of refugees who've had to leave their entire experiences and memories and loved ones and belongings somewhere else. Maybe it's the grief of climate disaster, right? Losing the world as we know it. None of that grief is the kind of closed grief of death. Death is grievous, but it's a moment, you know, it's again, a moment in time that happens. It has a sort of a beginning and then a middle and an end. And we have traditions and we go through the process of mourning in ways that can bring great comfort. But if you are experiencing ambiguous grief, like my dad had dementia. So we lost my father, and this is the case for millions of families. We lost my father over years in small increments. And as we lost him, we lost parts of our relationships with him and with each other. We lost parts of our identities. Like, no one talks about that kind of open-ended ambiguity that happens without you even realizing it. And then you wake up one morning and you're a different person, or you feel a sadness, or you don't even have the words for what it looks like.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing. And it's one of the things that I have tried to do with this show is to broaden our understanding of what grief is. You know, the grief connected to the death of somebody you love is difficult and emotional and challenging and has no endpoint and all of these things. And we have language to talk about that. Right. Like we recognize how, you know, the short shelf life that we allow people grieving a death. Yeah. Set to the side for a second. Like, we get it,
right,
that you're grieving when your sister dies or your mom dies or your best friend dies. We don't have language, ritual, support, structure for the grief that happens as you lose somebody by degrees, the grief that happens when your career does not go the way that you want it to. I think we start getting really possessive of what the word grief is allowed to be used for.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think too, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Pauline Boss's work. Right.
Yeah.
So I came to her work because I was studying trauma and resilience. At the very beginning of COVID, there was a lot being talked about in terms of trauma and resilience and what was to come. And what really struck me was that, in fact, it wasn't trauma, it was grief.
Yeah.
And that we were grieving in this open-ended way for things we couldn't name. And she has a good framework for that. And what's interesting to me is that we're in such an individualistic culture that most people perceive resilience as a trait that they have or that they can develop. When in fact, in terms of grief in particular, and ambiguous grief even more so, the thing that enables you to adapt and survive and maybe eventually come to a new place is your relationships, right? Mm-hmm. It's the community that you form around you and the belonging that you can cultivate or the meaning that you derive. So that's a relational resilience.
Yeah, which is different than this like buck up, little camper, yeah. Be strong. Don't let the world bug you. Don't let things get you down. Just plow ahead, endless forward movement. Yes. Optimism by demand, right? It's that thing of like the whole resilience narrative really irks me.
Yeah. And resilience. I'm reading a book about resilience. So
oh, yay. I cannot wait. Yay. Oh my gosh. I'm so glad to hear that. Like the resilience, we could totally nerd out about this one, but like resilience just really irks me because resilience is the thing that we demand of people. Like, yes, difficult things happen, but we don't want to hear about it. We only want to hear you rise above. Like, yeah. it's another way to silence
totally
somebody's experience and to separate them.
Have a positive attitude. Can't you be positive? Yeah.
Yeah. How dare you have feelings that aren't forward moving, positive thinking? It goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago of like, you know, the entire capitalistic structure of forward human progress would collapse if we allowed ourselves to be sad and angry. Like, hello.
Another thing, we've been dancing around this, but productivity culture is a tool, but it's used against us, right? Like, I think a lot about pregnancy loss and even childbirth as a process of grief that women sometimes go to. You give birth to a child and then you realize what you've lost, right? You realize, oh, I'm not the person I was before. And I'm at this new person, or I have these new relationships. And that doesn't mean you don't love your child, but there is a difference in your life, right? And so there's no recognition of any of that. There's no recognition of what women go through anyway, or people who have children. There's no sense in the culture, particularly American culture, that it's tiring. It's hard work. Mm-hmm. We need rest, right? Because in fact, the goal is to get back to normal, which means optimizing yourself, peak performance, positive attitudes, like all this bullshit.
Endless
bullshit. And we just are not kind to people. We just don't have a caring ethic.
Yeah. Like the whole medicalization of grief is about a return to productivity, right? Sure. Like, when can you go back to work and complete your job without being distracted? When can you go back to consumer culture and being up and positive and optimistic? Like, right. When can we package you and your grief, your emotions, your anger, your sadness, your disappointment are all way too messy for us to make productive hours out of. And that is terrifying for the systems that exist.
Yeah, I mean, the systems that exist are not interested.
No. There's something else that I want to bring in here. Like, this territory has been my preferred ground since I was a teenager. Like, I love this stuff. And when my partner drowned, I no longer gave a shit about this.
Yeah.
Obviously, I care about it again now, but I think when loss erupts into your life, these conversations feel very distant and very theoretical.
And it's despondence is the response. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Because it feels like nothing matters.
And that these conversations about the larger cultural and interpersonal sweeps have no bearing on the actual intimate life that I am living at this time. And I get that. And I think these conversations are really, really important because the culture that we create together, the structures that we create together, have a direct impact on how your emotional experience after a big loss, how that gets seen and how that gets supported. And maybe like in that tight orb of a big catastrophic loss or a catastrophic injury or illness, like maybe that is not the time for philosophical conversations for you. And knowing that your personal experience sits within a culture that is armed against you.
Hostile
to you. You're right. Hostile to you is part of why it's so difficult to be a grieving person in this culture, because the systems are in place to make the world a very hostile place for grievers. And I think like situating yourself in that and understanding that it's not just you. It's not just you. It's the world.
The world. And also, we're in the culture. We can't be out of the culture, really. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to live in the world. It's a capitalist society. Most of us have to earn money to feed ourselves and our families. Like, these are realities, right? But the other thing too is when like, this is the case with anger. Part of the real reason I wrote the book was to show how social anger is, to show how constructed it is. Same thing with grief, right? Same thing with the idea of emotions. We think of emotions as an internal state of an individual, as opposed to the way we communicate between individuals as interpersons. Emotions make us interpersons. We enter into, we become a new thing when we're sharing emotions with a person or with a community. But because we are so individualistic, we fail to think, for example, in terms of communal grief, historic grief, cultural grief, sort of loss experienced over time periods that are way outside the average lifespan, and why those are still relevant. It's like the diagnosis of PTSD. Diagnosis of PTSD is an individual diagnosis of trauma. And when the diagnosis was made, it helped a lot of people, mainly soldiers coming back from wars, Vietnam. But in fact, it's simultaneously, by saying trauma is resident in an individual's mind, it simultaneously erased historic trauma of Indigenous peoples, or trauma related to racism, for example. It ignored the grief and trauma of women who experience rape, because it said trauma of this sort, grief of this sort, anger of this sort comes from a violent attack by a stranger or in a war, which nobody could conceive a woman experiencing that in her own home.
Yeah. Yeah. This idea that making the diagnosis, making a definition, legitimizes certain kinds of emotional, relational, neurological response, and at the same time erases any other expression of it.
Yeah, because it invalidates everything else, you know. And so we still, for example, in the DSM, the Manual of Diagnostics used in the United States, complex PTSD, which was suggested by Judith Herman like in the late 70s, early 80s, to describe the experiences, particularly of women living with domestic violence or sexual violence, it's still not part of the DSM.
Nope.
You know?
It's starting to get some airtime with authors like Stephanie Fu and Emmy Neatfield, who we've had on the show earlier this season. But that's the thing, right? Like, hello, it's 2023. Like, can we start talking about the lives of girls and women and the effects of millennia of trauma, violence, displacement, and what does that do to a body?
With like, you know, sort of a post-enslavement syndrome, like the effects, the intergenerational effects of violence and enslavement on American Black communities doesn't quite fit into the definition of PTSD.
Doesn't quite. No, and there's no clear five-step plan to get yourself out of those things to go be a productive American. Like, there's just, it starts to get really overwhelming when you start to see how big the web is. I remember when I was in grad school, I remember that an advisor of mine was a psychiatrist within one of the last remaining inpatient long-term residential psych units. And she said, I never checked this out, so if this wasn't accurate and she was telling tales, I don't know. But one of the things she said was that, you know, there's a tendency to romanticize psychosis, but I can tell you that a lot of my current patients are women who were researching deep women's history and the history of people of color, and it broke their brains.
Oh,
and they couldn't mesh the pain and suffering that they were seeing, like how far that rabbit hole goes with daily lived culture, and it broke something in them. And I think that this is one of the reasons that we don't always explore this stuff is, one, in our own pain, this bigger sweep of pain feels distant and irrelevant. And I think another thing that really strikes me sometimes, and I love this stuff, but I think another thing that really strikes people is it's so immense and so violent and so hostile, and it's everywhere. And how do we find a corner of that to hold on to and not lose our minds?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've been talking about this, actually, this exact topic now, talking to myself about it, but also to friends I know that would understand this. You know, for years I wrote almost exclusively about sexual violence. And what happened in that process was, not only did I know my own experience of sexual violence in the culture, which I'd really always known, like really from the age of 8 or 9. But I then experienced secondary trauma from the process of listening to other people's stories, studying, writing. And I don't think people understand enough about secondary trauma and the grief you feel. Like you just described the grief you feel when you realize what a massive task we have ahead of us. So I struggle a lot with the notion of hope, because in fact, the despondence that can settle on you is honestly, in some ways, I think it, in my case, it felt self-indulgent because I could afford to be despondent. I read a lot and I think a lot about people who've gone through this process over the last century and written about it and talked about it, and they've come to a place of hope and hopefulness as a practice, as what has to happen, and try and learn from them, because it is easy to fall down that rabbit hole and think, my God, how will we dig ourselves out? Mm. And I will say this, I've done many podcasts in the last 10 years, 5 years, 10 years, but very few people ever want to go down this path, because in fact, they want to give people something positive.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. They want to end on a high note. And I'm like, well, maybe I'm not your gal right now.
You're singing my song, friend.
You know, I'm like, okay, but did you know that before you asked me? Because in fact, there's some things where you just have to sit with the badness, which isn't really fun for people at a dinner party, I understand.
I've been talking with Saraya Shamali, author of the best-selling book, Rage Becomes Her. Part 2 of our conversation is out next week. Be sure to check the show notes for ways to learn more about Saraya's work, and stick around for your questions to carry with you for part 1 of this episode right after this break.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last 1.5 years. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Each week, I leave you with some questions to carry with you until we meet again. Now, you know what really struck me in this conversation? Okay, well, two things. Lots of things, but I'm only going to share two. One, it has been nearly two decades since my 20s. Actually, quick math, it's more than that. Whatever. But that was the time when I was really diving into research on anger and oppression and how that intersects with women's rights and environmental destruction and activism. So it was really cool to go back there with Soraya. Number two thing for this part of the episode, at one point, I think it is maybe in part two of our conversation, but Soraya and I were talking about books and how anger itself is an endless well of material. So if you have a book on anger in you, please do it. Please write that book. There's just so much to say. There's so much to say about anger. There's a part two of this conversation coming up next week, so don't miss that one. And be sure to let us know what came up for you during this conversation on anger and grief and connection. Everyone's going to take something different from today's show, but I do hope you find something to hold on to. Check out Refuge in Grief on Instagram or HereAfterPod on TikTok to see video clips from the show and leave your thoughts in the comments on those posts. And be sure to tag us in your own anger conversation starting posts on your own social media. Use the hashtag HereAfterPod on all the platforms. We love to see where this show takes you. Remember to subscribe and do leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to shows. Those reviews help more than you know. Want more Hereafter? Grief education doesn't just belong to end-of-life issues. Life is full of losses, from everyday disappointments to events that clearly divide life into before and after. Learning how to talk about all that without cliches or platitudes or simplistic think positive posters is an important skill for everyone. Find trainings, workshops, books, and resources for every human trying to make their way in the world after something goes horribly wrong at megandevine.co. Hereafter with Megan Devine is written and produced by me, Megan Devine. Executive producer is Amy Brown and Elizabeth Fazio. Edited by Houston Tilley. Music provided by Wavecrush.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA. And I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.